go. VOA Weather Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, Faith Perlow, and Dan Friedel. Later, we will present part 3 of Love of Life by Jack London on American Stories. But first,
as students return to classrooms in the United States, many parents are still not able to return to work. They are finding that after-school child care programs are in short supply. School-based providers list difficulties in hiring and keeping workers as the biggest reasons they have not fully recovered from pandemic shutdowns. Providers say they are as worried about the situation as the parents who are without child care. "We're in a constant state of flux. We'll hire one staffer and another will resign. We've just not been able to catch up this year," said Esther Buendia. She is assistant director for after-school programs at Northside Independent School District in Texas. Before the pandemic, the local after-school program Learning Tree had 1,000 workers. They served more than 7,000 students at about 100 elementary and middle schools. Today, there are fewer than 500 employees serving about 3,300 students. More than 1,100 students are on waiting lists for the program. It provides educational, recreational, and social activities every school day outside of school hours. Studies suggest parents, mostly mothers, are staying home for their children because they are unable to find after-school programming. That causes worker shortages at such programs that depend heavily on women to run them. There's no doubt, really, that these after-school programs, the lack of after-school programs, are limiting women in particular being able to re-enter the workforce, said Jen Reinhardt. She leads planning and programming for the nonprofit group After School Alliance. "If women don't return to the workforce, then we don't have the staff we need for these after-school opportunities, so it's all very tangled together," she said. An After School Alliance study found a record high of 24.6 million children were unable to enter a program at the end of 2021. The researchers looked at more than 1,000 program providers. They found 54% had waiting lists, a much larger share than in the past. Wells Fargo reported that labor shortages in child care are more severe than in other industries also struggling to find dependable employees. Employment was 12.4% below its pre-COVID-19 level at the beginning of March. That leaves an estimated 460,000 families forced to make other plans, the researchers found. Erica Gonzalez of San Antonio got after-school care for her daughters, who are in second and sixth grade. That permitted her to keep her job at a nonprofit and her husband, a teacher, to also coach. Gonzalez had made sure to register her children for Learning Tree as early as possible. She also kept in contact with the girls' schools through the process. Gonzalez said, "We were really just kind of hoping and praying for placement in the program." The After School Alliance survey found that 71% of programs had taken action to hold on to its workers and appeal to job seekers. The most common measure was to increase wages. In some cases, programs used federal pandemic relief money in the form of child care awards. Some also have offered free child care for employees, as well as extra money or paid time off. Reinhardt described a tremendous unmet demand for after-school and summer programs even before the pandemic. She said the health crisis has made the problem worse.
Nigerian students who want to escape poverty can learn science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, for the cost of 100 naira, or about 25 cents a day. Faridat Bakare is a 12-year-old student at NOSC Secondary School in Abuja. She started in the school in 2020, a year after it opened. She wants to be an engineer. In a technical lab at the school, she shows a design for a solar-powered car made from cardboard for her class project. "I want to become an electrical engineer who works with robots and solar panels and all the connections of all the snap circuits and things like that," said Bakari. She lives with her mother and four siblings in a poor neighborhood in Abuja. NOSC School runs largely on donations. The school currently has 82 students, but is expanding each year. School officials visit each family to establish whether they can pay for the cost of education. The amount could be as high as $159 for a term. Irene Bengwell, the founder of NOSC, is a former teacher. She said the idea of a science high school for poor children came to her 8 years ago. At the time, she took her child to a hospital and heard a cleaner there telling another patient that her young daughter was also a cleaner instead of being in school. Bengwell added, "When we decided to run the NOSC school, we had to ask ourselves, what kind of education does a poor man's child need to break out of poverty?" She says she plans to set up more such schools in Nigeria. At least 10.5 million children in Nigeria do not attend school. The United Nations said in January that is the highest rate in the world. Most affected are girls, children with disabilities, and those from poor families. Students at NOSC spend 75% of their time studying STEM. When they finish their studies, each student has to develop a design of something they can use or continue to develop after school. For the cost of 25 cents a day, students are given clothes, books, and food. Fawzat Bakari is Faridat's mother. She believes her daughter's education at NOSC will help the family. I believe that she will wipe away my tears. All my suffering will end through her, Bakari said from her home, as she selected cassava, a local vegetable, to sell at a market. I'm Susan Shand.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question from Yuna from Japan. I would like to know the difference between every day and every day. Thank you. Dear Yuna, people often confuse every day, one word, and every day, two words, because they can be used in similar ways. Let us start with the one word, every day. We use every day, one word, as an adjective to describe nouns. Its meaning is something that happens regularly, from day to day. My everyday schedule includes waking up early, going to the gym, and making breakfast. In this example, every day, one word, describes the schedule or the plan of activities that can happen every morning. Another way we can use every day as an adjective is to mean in an ordinary or usual way. He wears sneakers as his everyday shoes. In this statement, the sneakers are his usual shoes. Now let us look at the two-word form of every day. This form is a grouping of two separate words, every, adjective, and day, noun. It means the same as the expression each day. We use every day, two words, as an adverb phrase to describe verbs, other adverbs, and adjectives. Compare these examples. The children go to school every day. Eating vegetables every day is important for our health. In the first example, every day, two words, can be replaced by every single day, each day, or even another expression, like every week or every month. In the second example, every day, two words, describes how often we should eat our vegetables. Please let us know if these explanations and examples have helped you, Yuna. Next week, we will answer a question from Melvin about daily and every day. If you are interested in how these expressions are similar or different, please come back next week to find out. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perla.
The American movie industry will hold the Academy Awards, known as the Oscars, on Sunday in Los Angeles. Some movie critics think Coda may be the first movie from a media streaming service to win the Best Picture Award. Coda is about a deaf family with a daughter who can hear. The movie was made by Apple TV Plus, Apple's streaming service. It won the top award from the Producers Guild and Screen Actors Guild, two movie industry groups, earlier this year. The first film from a streaming service to be nominated for Best Picture came in 2016. The movie was Amazon's Manchester by the Sea. That year, the winner was Spotlight, about the Boston Globe newspaper. The main competition for Coda this year appears to be from Netflix, another streaming service. It is the film The Power of the Dog. That movie won the top award from three other movie industry groups this year. Marley Matlin is one of the main actors in Coda. She is also deaf. she won an Oscar for her performance in the 1986 film Children of a Lesser God. It would be great for a streamer to win, I think, because it just expands the landscape, Matlin said. An Oscar win, even a nomination, lifts the financial performance of a movie. The media market research company ComScore follows movie ticket sales. It said ticket sales for Best Picture nominees Dune and King Richard each increased by about 4 times after being nominated. 7 of the 10 films nominated for Best Picture can be watched using streaming services. The other 3 can be purchased or rented to watch at home. It is possible that instead of ticket sales, the streaming services will gain more subscribers after Sunday's awards are announced. Dune, West Side Story, and Nightmare Alley are all available on HBO Max. A spokesperson for the service said all 3 movies recently had more people watching them. When Jessica Chastain was nominated for Best Actress, her film, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, had a 42% increase in viewers. One movie business expert said 10 years ago, the movie studios used buzz from award shows to get people to buy tickets. Now, the expert said, all of these streamers have something to gain. Kerry Washington is one of Hollywood's top actors. Although more people are watching movies at home, she does not think it is the death of anything. Washington said, I think we're just having more and more options and ways to appreciate content. I'm Dan Friedel.
Love of Life by Jack London. Part 3.
The man had brought his gun half the distance to his shoulder before he realized what he was doing. He lowered it and drew his hunting knife from its cover. Before him was meat and life. He ran his finger along the edge of the knife. It was sharp. The point was sharp. He would throw himself on the bear and kill it. But his heart began its pounding. Then came its wild leap, and he began to feel faint. His wild courage was replaced by a great fear. In his weakness, what if the animal attacked him? He drew himself up tall, grasping the knife and staring hard at the bear. The bear advanced a couple of steps and stood up. If the man ran, the bear would run after him. But the man did not run. He was alive now with the courage of fear. The bear moved away to one side with a threatening noise. He himself was fearful of this strange creature that appeared unafraid. But the man did not move. He stood still until the danger was past. Then he yielded to a fit of trembling and sank to his knees on the wet grass. He regained control of himself and then started to move forward, afraid now in a new manner. It was not the fear that he would die from lack of food. He was afraid that he would be destroyed by forces other than starving. There were the wolves. Across the wasteland, their howls could be heard, making the air itself a threat most real to him. Now and again the wolves in groups of 2 and 3 crossed his path, but they stayed away from him. They were not in sufficient numbers to attack, and besides, they were hunting caribou. Caribou did not battle, while this strange creature that walked on 2 legs might bite. In the afternoon he came upon scattered bones where the wolves had made a kill. What remained had been a young caribou an hour before. He studied the bones, cleaned of any flesh. They were still pink with the life in them, which had not yet died. Might he look like that before the day was done? Was this life a fleeting thing without meaning? It was only life that pained. There was no hurt in death. To die was to sleep. It meant rest. Then why was he not content to die? But he did not think about these things for very long. He was soon seated in the grass, a bone in his mouth, biting at the bit of life that made it yet pink. The sweet, meaty taste drove him mad. He closed his teeth firmly on the bones. Sometimes it was the bone that broke, sometimes his teeth. Then he crushed the bones between the rocks. He pounded them into tiny pieces and ate them. He was in such a hurry that he pounded his fingers, too. He felt surprised at the fact that his fingers did not hurt much when they were caught under the rock. Then came frightful days of snow and rain. He did not know when he made camp and when he broke camp. He traveled in the night as much as in the day. He rested whenever he fell, moving ahead whenever the dying life in him started up again. He, as a man, no longer struggled. It was the life in him, unwilling to die, that drove him on. He did not suffer, nor feel pain, but his mind was filled with hallucinations and wild dreams. But he still ate the crushed bones of the young caribou, which he had gathered and carried with him. He crossed no more hills, but followed a large stream which flowed through a wide valley. He did not see this stream, nor this valley. He saw nothing except hallucinations. One morning he awakened with his mind clear, lying on his back on a rocky surface. The sun was shining bright and warm. Far away he heard the noises made by the young caribou. He remembered rain and wind and snow. But whether he had been beaten by the storm for 2 days or 2 weeks, he did not know. For some time he lay without movement. The friendly sun poured down upon him and filled his body with its warmth. A fine day, he thought. Perhaps he could succeed in locating himself. By a painful effort, he rolled on his side. Below him flowed a wide river. Its unfamiliarity puzzled him. Slowly he followed it with his eyes as it curved among the bare hills. They were more bare and lower than any hills he had yet seen. Slowly, without excitement, he followed the course of the strange stream toward the skyline and saw that it emptied into a bright and shining sea. He was still unexcited. Most unusual, he thought. It was probably a trick of his mind. He was certain of this when he also saw a ship floating in the shining sea. He closed his eyes for a while, then opened them. It was strange how the sight continued, yet it was not strange. He knew there were no seas or ships in the middle of this land, as he had known there was no cartridge in the empty gun. He heard a noise behind him. It seemed like the dry sound that comes from the throat when air is forced out in a cough. Very slowly, because of his weakness and stiffness, he rolled to his other side. He could see nothing near, but he waited patiently. Again came the cough, and there, between two rocks, he saw the gray head of a wolf. The sharp ears did not stand up as straight as he had seen them on other wolves. The eyes were dull, and the head seemed to hang. The animal opened and shut its eyes frequently in the sunshine. It seemed sick. As he looked, it coughed again. This was real, he thought. He turned on the other side to see the reality of the world which had been hidden from him before by his hallucination. But the sea still shone, and the ship was still there. Was it reality? He closed his eyes for a long while and thought. And then he remembered. He had been traveling north by east, away from the Deese Divide and into the Coppermine Valley. This wide river was the Coppermine. That shining sea was the Arctic Ocean. That ship was a fishing boat which had wandered east from the mouth of the Mackenzie River. Now it was lying in Coronation Gulf. He remembered the map that he had seen long ago, and it was all clear and reasonable to him. He sat up and turned his attention to immediate affairs. He had worn holes through the blanket wrappings, and his feet were like shapeless pieces of meat. His last blanket was gone. His gun and knife were both lost. He had also lost his hat somewhere, with the matches and the band. The matches against his chest were safe and dry inside the paper. He looked at his watch. It marked 11 o'clock and was still going. This proved that he had kept it wound. He was calm. Although very weak, he had no feeling of pain. He was not hungry. The thought of food was not even pleasant to him. Whatever he did was done entirely by reasoning. He tore off the legs of his trousers to the knees and bound them about his feet. Somehow he had succeeded in keeping the tin container. He would have some hot water before he began what he knew was to be an awful journey to the ship. His movements were slow. He shook as if with a disease. When he started to gather dried grasses, he found he could not rise to his feet. He tried again and again. Then he contented himself with moving about on his hands and knees. Once he went near the sick wolf. The animal dragged itself out of the way, licking its face with a tongue which seemed hardly to have the strength to curl. The man noticed that the tongue was not the customary healthy red, but was a yellowish-brown and covered with a half-dried coating. After he drank some hot water, the man found he was able to stand. He could even walk as well as a dying man might be supposed to walk. But every minute or two he was forced to rest. His steps were unsteady, as were the steps of the wolf behind him. That night, when the shining sea was hidden in the blackness, he knew he was nearer to it by no more than 4 miles. Through the night he heard the cough of the sick wolf, now and then the noises of the young caribou. There was life all around him, but it was strong life, very much alive and well. He knew the sick wolf was following the sick man's steps in the hope that the man would die first. In the morning, when he opened his eyes, he saw it looking at him with a hungry stare. It stood with its tail between its legs like an unhappy dog. The sun rose brightly, and all morning the man headed toward the ship on the shining sea. The weather was perfect. It was the brief return of summer which was usual in that country. Might continue for a week, or tomorrow or the next day it might be gone.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.